You're listening to Grow Great, the podcast, helping leaders establish and sustain high-performance cultures in their careers, teams, and organizations. Welcome inside the Yellow Studio. My name is Randy Cantrell. I'm your host here. This is Episode 7, Season 2021. Sherry Chaney Jones. Today, we're going to talk about measuring high-performance impact in the public sector. I'm glad that you clicked play. I hope you're a subscriber. If you're not, well, get with it. The website is growgreat.com. You can find out more about me and all the work that we do and find all the podcast episodes at growgreat.com. Joining me today via Zoom is Sherry Chaney Jones. She is out of Columbus, Ohio. She is an expert on public sector evaluation and applied organizational research. Sherry is the president and founder of Measurement Resources, a consulting company dedicated to helping the social sector with performance management, evaluation, and organizational behavior. She is also the author of Impact and Excellence, Data-Driven Strategies for Aligning Mission, Culture, and Performance in Nonprofit and Government Organizations. Enjoy this conversation that I had with Sherry just this past week, and at the end of it, we'll put a bow on this thing and give you back the rest of your day. Enjoy. Well, Dr. Childs introduced us, and I'm real happy that he did, but let's give some context to the audience. So, because my audience knows Sherry, you know, this is really about high-performing cultures, high-performing careers, high-performing groups and teams and organizations. And you and I share at least a sliver of commonality in my work with city government, which I think is why David introduced us. But tell us, just to give us a little bit of background about yourself and how you got into this.
Sure. Thank you, Randy. It's great to be here and with others that are interested in high performance in the government space. So I've built my whole career creating high performing measurement cultures within the government space, somewhat by accident, but definitely super excited that I have. I'm an industrial and organizational psychologist by training and thought I would be designing selection tests for a living. Extremely passionate about how do we use data to predict performance. Luckily, the universe had a different path for me. My very first career out of graduate school was working with individuals who were working with people with severe and persistent mental illness and helping them use data to help them achieve their employment goals. So what I realized was, wow, there is a whole career here in the public sector where we can use data to improve outcomes. And when we talk about outcomes in the social sector, it's not just outcomes like, you know, increased sales or increased profits like it is in the for-profit. It's actually changing lives and strengthening communities. So I got really excited about the opportunity to bring high-performing practices and data-driven strategies to the public sector. And I was fortunate enough to have two high-level senior positions within one within a county government and then again, state level. And after working with both of these entities, implementing high-performing measurement strategies and frankly, experiencing real lasting results for them, where the juvenile court, we were able to decrease recidivism, improve our federal funding so we could do more programming. And then at the state of Ohio, using these practices, we were able to prove to the state legislature how our work was saving the state of Ohio $250 million a year in Medicaid by keeping seniors in their own homes when they were sick enough and qualified for Medicaid instead of forcing them to move to nursing homes. And that particular project is what inspired me to step away from government work and start my own consulting firm, Measurement Resources Company, because I looked around and the nonprofits that we funded as a funder at the state level, as well as our sister agencies, I was looking around saying, why aren't they using these practices? Why aren't they adopting these high-performing practices? Why aren't they measuring their impact, communicating their impact, so that they really are creating effective and lasting strategies that are improving the lives in the communities and saving taxpayer dollars? So I thought, well, I guess one way to solve that problem is to help as many organizations as possible do this work. So that's when I left state government. It's been about over 10 years now, working with organizations all over the country, government, nonprofit, social enterprise, helping them implement these high-performing measurement strategies so they do create real and lasting social change.
What answer did you find as to why? I mean, my speculation would be largely they don't know how.
Yep, they don't know how is one of the answers. Interestingly, so prior to becoming an entrepreneur and a trainer and a coach and all of the things I am today, when I was at state government thinking about leaving, I thought, well, I don't know. Will anyone pay for this? Is there a market here? So I did the only thing I knew how to do, and that was I launched an unfunded market research study, which became the results became my book, Impact and Excellence. And I asked that very same question. I wanted to figure out what were the barriers getting in the way? Did leaders value these practices? Did they know about these practices? And the answers we got are things that you would predict. Not enough time, not enough money, not enough staff. They don't have staff that know what they're doing. So those were our most common answers. But what we also found, which is why I'm so passionate about this work, is that we found that those organizations who were implementing these practices were significantly more likely, just like the two organizations I had worked with previously, were significantly more likely to experience all of the things leadership wanted. They were raising more money from tax levies or legislature or other sources, grants. They were more effective and efficient in their operations. They were creating greater impact in their community. Their staff had better collaboration and cooperation, and the organizational culture was greater and stronger. Similar to if you did listen to Dr. Child's podcast, things that he had found as well. And so this encouraged me. I knew that creating these cultures mattered, but yet we had all of these what people would call excuses as why they were not implementing these practices. But the secret is what I found is that there was no correlation between the size of an organization and their ability to create these high-performing measurement cultures. So that's why I say that that not enough staff, not enough time, not enough money, those are not real barriers. Those are just excuses. So if we could just get into an organization, give them the tools, work within their culture, work within their budget, they can achieve those results as well. And so that's what excites me every day, because it's not about having a big budget and a big staff. It's about doing the right things at the right time to be more efficient and high performing.
Sherry, people in my audience, and it varies. I mean, they can be HR directors that work in a city government. They could be city managers. They could be CEOs. They could be vice presidents. Mm-hmm. They could be solo entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. Do you find, or let me rephrase it, how do you find it when it's something that comes from the top down versus something that is birthed somewhere much lower in the organization? I would surmise, I mean, I know in my work, Mm-hmm. And when the number one puts an edict out, that authority and that power, coupled with that leadership, absolutely help propel things. Mm-hmm. But I find myself engaged in conversations where people think that if that doesn't happen, then what am I going to do where I'm at?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the number one difference we found, because after I learned that it wasn't money, wasn't size, it wasn't budget, then, okay, what is it? What is that? Again, remember, I love to predict performance. So what is that one thing that really makes a high-performing measurement culture stick, those practices stick? And we did find the willingness and commitment of the leader is a huge predictor. So of the leadership team. If a leadership team truly bought into it and saw how it could transform their organization, that was definitely a huge predictor. However, we also see that if those in the organization that aren't CEO or aren't, you know, the chief missions officer or whatever that title is, that if those leaders also embrace this concept that I'm a huge fan of, that is, leadership is an action, not a title, and they really embrace that, they can influence change from the ground up, because every person has the ability to implement metrics in what they do. It doesn't have to come from your boss. If you're implementing a new program, you can implement metrics around how well that's working, or you can track your own performance. You know, you can decide like, hey, these are things that matter to me. I'm going to track and measure them and communicate them up. And so just doing those things within your own work or within your department's work can get you noticed and influence what's happening, others interested in what you're doing, and start to replicate it.
Share with us your thoughts about speed, the speed of the implementation, the speed of the improvement. I'm surmising, because I know in my own work, people are all often kind of fascinated with how quickly something can change.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, when they're committed,
yeah.
When they come in and they're kind of whole hog into giving it a go.
Yeah.
So speed and, you know, what the world loves to call engagement, you know,
sure,
where the team, the organization, they begin to take ownership of it.
Yeah.
Your experiences in those two areas.
So I think that we can obviously, if we have greater engagement into a new initiative or into new high performing practices, it will have sticking power. It'll last longer. It won't be a fad that goes away in 3 or 4 months. So buy-in from all levels of the organization is critical. So how we recommend doing that is first starting with the end in mind. So if you know that, hey, this is what we're driving to, these are the metrics that we care about, but then bringing that to the different departments or the different people leading those initiatives and asking them for how would you measure this? Or what is your workflow and how can we incorporate that data collection or, you know, those pieces of information that will help us guide our work? Getting them to devise a plan, because then it's not something that's done for you. You're co-creating the experience, you're co-creating the process, and that will create a much further process. And then when we talk about change, like, you know, creating real impact. For example, when I was at the juvenile court, we had a problem. The leadership came to me and they said, you know what, there's something wrong with our overtime policy. Will you look into it and will you fix it? And I said, you know what, I'll fix your overtime policy if it needs fixed. However, let's also look at what else is going on. Let's look at staff engagement. Let's look at staff perception of safety. Let's look at the youth experience. So we added more metrics around mission in addition to just the overtime policy situation. And we learned a lot of things. We learned that one, they were holding vacancies open to save money, which is really driving the turnover burnout problem. But 10% of the staff, only 10% of the staff felt safe in that working environment, which is huge. That is not going to increase productivity. That's not going to help anyone. So I said, you know what? We got to hire the people you need to staff your agency properly. And we're going to start managing to these other metrics. We're going to stop managing just to overtime. We're going to start managing to staff safety. We're going to start managing to recidivism. We're going to start managing to the things that matter most to your organization, why your organization exists. And within 18 months' time, they had decreased their recidivism by half, and they had increased their staff safety perceptions from 10% to 75%. So things can, like you said, Randy, things can change really quickly if you're focused on the right things. And I think that 2020, with all the things that have gone on with that, has taught us that, right? How quickly did organizations have to pivot? Where before, remote, no way, we can never do work remote. Boom, now we're all at home doing our work remote. And so when we're met, if we're measuring to the mission, and we're making decisions related to the mission, we can really speed up our impact.
I had some CEOs. It's interesting with the pandemic and all of the Zoom calls and everything. CEOs that 2 years ago would have, you know, it was butts in the seat, heads at desks, and that was the measurement for performance.
Right? Yeah.
And the pandemic comes, and now people are having communication much like you and I are having it. And one CEO said to me pretty early on in the pandemic, said, you know, it's pretty remarkable. I've got my people at home and we're seeing each other in the background. I mean, you can see, you know, I mean, I got Tweedledee and Tweedledum. So, you know, my background is probably different, but we see people in their environment, and there's just, there's some kind of a human connection that's happening. And I've had more than a handful of CEOs say, you know, they never began a meeting just kind of checking in on people as far as the humanity goes, but they are now.
Sure.
And productivity has increased in many, many cases. The things that you come in and measure, are companies prone to make assumptions and then feel like they've got data that backs up those assumptions? Because it seems to me in my business experience, countless CEOs can be very guilty of that, right? We, sure, we see what we want to see. I'm here in Dallas, Texas, and Jerry Jones is an easy scapegoat to pick on, the owner of the Cowboys, and he gets criticized every year for, you know, he overestimates how good his players are. And CEOs can do the same thing. They can either overestimate the productivity of their employees, or they can underestimate it. I mean, they can go from one extreme to the other. Those measurements and those things that you bring to light, how often do you find yourself, or give me some insights into, you know, dispelling the kinds of myths that I would suspect that you do a lot of myth busting when you come in. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's but it's an inquisitive, curious process.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said.
Journey. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think that one thing that, especially if we're talking about the public sector, one thing we've fallen into is what I call it the outputs trap, and getting really caught up in measuring what we do and not focusing on how well we're doing it. And is anyone better off? I mean, at the end of the day, the reason that public entities exist is because us as a community have agreed that, whether it's through our representatives or a tax levy or whatever, but we have all agreed that these things matter to us and that we want the government to fill a need that a private sector isn't filling or isn't the best entity to fill, right? And so, yet we forget to measure those end results, why we exist. And so I think that's the biggest myth buster. And a great example of this is a program that we were asked to measure. And the people who developed this program were extremely passionate about serving young people. Extremely passionate about it. Program model, if you looked at the design, they looked like there was nothing wrong with it. It looked like it, yeah, this should help a young person change their thinking and you know, achieve greater success in life. But when we went to really measure its impact, we learned that, unfortunately, the program was making kids worse. Kids who were enrolled in this program were more likely to get go back into the juvenile justice system than those who were not enrolled into it, but with the same, you know, same charges, same socioeconomic status, keeping everything the same. And I'm so grateful that that program learned that there was something going on there that they needed to fix. Because if not, how many children would have been forced to go into a program that was designed by no fault of anyone to make them worse? Like, I think that's the tragedy. And that's why I think it's so important that we, especially as public leaders, think about why does our agency exist? What problem are we here to solve? And make sure we have metrics around that and we're managing to that. We're not just managing to busy work, you know, how many, because, you know, before they were just tracking, oh, well, we served thousands of kids and we did this many sessions and aren't we great? Well, you can be great if you tweak some things, if you manage to the right outcomes. And so I think in the public sector, that's the one thing that when you talk about, are they overestimating? Yes, they overestimate the impact that they're having, because they're not even measuring it to know.
Yeah. Well, that law of unintended consequences and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested in the psychological aspect in, you know, the whole organizational behavior part of it, the human behavior part of it, because the interesting thing to me about your work is that intersection between what I would call hard science. Mm-hmm. And then there's the reality of how I feel. And I mean, you mentioned safety. Mm-hmm. You know, I do a podcast with a gentleman, Leo Battari, and he's a fellow, he's done a lot of research about group dynamic, particularly peer groups. Mm-hmm. And he gets very focused on psychological safety, that if there's not psychological safety in the workplace, teamwork, high performing teamwork breaks down. Mm-hmm. So that intersection between the two, I don't know. I mean, I'm curious your experience with those two and the way to marry those two in the minds, especially of your clients who are great beneficiaries of your work.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you picked that up, because we have had the opportunity to work with some large state entities and do those types of more empirical studies where we've looked at the combination of, and it gets fascinating, because I think a lot of times there's research around this in the public sector or in the private sector where, you know, we've got organizational culture metrics and how that drives productivity, but typically productivity is measured in increased profits or increased revenues. So there's somewhat of a buy-in within the for-profit sector that staff engagement leads to greater productivity, but it's less studied in the public sector. And so a great example is we did a statewide research project on a home visiting program. So the program is designed to work with new mothers and make sure they have the resources and the tools that they need to, basically raise healthy children, be more successful parents. It's a voluntary program, typically serving low-income individuals. So we wanted to measure family engagement because it is a voluntary program. And if you can't engage the families into your program, it's very difficult to give them the education and the tools they need to be successful. So we looked at family factors. We looked at the home visiting characteristic factors. We looked at the relationship between the home visitors and their supervisors, and then, you know, some other contextual factors within the community. And one of the biggest drivers to family engagement was actually the relationship between the supervisor, the home visitor, and their supervisor. Like, it's something I intuitively knew, but it was so amazing to be able to see that empirically, that how safe and supported the home visitor felt with their supervisor allowed them to go into that family's home and do a better job at engaging them and delivering outcomes. Like, and I think it's the one thing that public sector, because they are so interested in cutting costs and being good stewards of public dollars, they forget that how we build our cultures and how we support our staff is just as important as how we engage our public stakeholders in the community. And there's one anecdotal story. I'm sure I have tons of others to prove that, but I'm such a data-driven person that if I can point to, like, look,
yeah,
strong relationships within an organization predict community outcomes. Let's invest here. Let's focus on it here.
No, it's great. And thanks for, it's a good illustration. So what does your company do then with that data? I mean, let's mm-hmm. pick on that story if you can.
Sure.
So if that relationship is that critical, then do you guys take the next step as far mm-hmm. as, okay, here's some things that you can do to improve that relationship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we had, part of that assessment, part of that survey looked at elements where those relationships were strong and where those relationships were weak. So we could go back to those teams and say, hey, you're high performing in, maybe your policies, but the, communication between supervisor and staff could use some improvement. So if you focus here, like I always like to think about, when you're a doctor, you use assessments to drill in with, well, what medicine should we take? What treatment should we take? We take organizational culture and change. Like, let's find that thing that if you focus here, if you implement something here, you're going to drive success over here. And so we use the assessments to isolate where can you improve. And oftentimes we actually know that if you improve in this area, you will increase your whatever the outcome is you're looking for by 4 points. I mean, because we've done the analysis that way. So it really helps leadership buy into focusing on those more cultural high performance practices because they know exactly how it will translate into results on the other side.
What gets in our way as leaders? Mm. So any of us who have, and I don't necessarily mean a title, although we tend to think of it in those terms of, mm-hmm. Being a boss as opposed to a leader. My personal opinion is we lead people, we manage the work.
Yeah.
But I get the world that we live in, and I understand how most people view it. But those psychological things, that safety things, that mm-hmm. that tone that we use, that way that we communicate, and all of those things. What are some of the big stumbling blocks? What are some of the big hurdles that your research has proven that if leaders would fix, a few key things mm-hmm. about ourselves, as opposed to just living by that excuse, well, this is just the way it is. This is just how I am.
Yeah.
I mean, what are some of those behaviors that your research has shown that we can do for our own self-improvement with or without help to try to be better leaders?
Sure. And I'm sure these answers I'm going to give you are universal. But one of the things we see a lot in government, especially when it comes to creating measures of outcomes, right? I told you the story about the group that learned they were making kids worse. That's a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is just sheer fear, protecting the ego, not wanting to learn bad news. So that is just, and I get it. It's a, I experience it too sometimes, where it's like,
sure.
I don't know if I want to ask that client for a testimonial because what if they say no, right? There's just that, there's that fear of not looking good. And then especially with the public sector, we have to recognize that there is a different level, or maybe there's not, but there's a perceived different level of accountability, right? Instead of, maybe just reporting to a board of directors, you're reporting to the entire public.
Yeah, well, it's a different land. It's a different, I mean, there are landmines in both places, but I would mm-hmm. say it's significantly.
So that fear, so what we help our clients do is repackage that fear and say, well, how, let's say we find out that you're not doing as well as you think you are. How do we actually, how do we spin it in a bad way, but how do we use that insights and information to actually make you look better? Because now you know something and you have the opportunity to improve it and to be innovative. And let's think about it as innovation and not think about it as like you're not successful or you didn't succeed. So we help flip the narrative. It's not about failing. It's about innovation and continuously improving. So that's one thing. I think fear is often something. And then I think just something universal is just all we can never learn enough empathy. I think that's just a skill that we can always be improving, meeting our teams, our coworkers, our stakeholders where they are. And I think, like you mentioned earlier about now we see into people's homes, how that kind of gives us a good insight that not everyone knows what we know. They don't all experience what we experience, and just taking time to really understand where the other person is coming from and making sure we're speaking, you know, communication is the root of all problems. Yeah. To quote a Cool Hand Luke.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Good reference.
Yeah.
What, and I'm not going to end on this note, but I'm curious about, you know, some failure that not that was your doing, but you know, when you've got data, have you run into a circumstance or a situation where people just absolutely didn't want to face it? They didn't want to deal with it. Has that ever happened to you? I'm just curious.
Oh, I think it happens a lot. We often are asked, because our work is typically public. If it's, you know, funded by the public, it could be public. People can ask for it.
Right.
So we often are asked, can you take that out, or, you know, and our answer is no.
Yeah, right.
So sometimes that does happen. It does happen. I think a lot of times we do get scapegoated a lot where, I don't want to say a lot, that sounds not true, but there occasionally, if we're delivering news that someone doesn't like, then they'll question the methods that were used to produce those results. So that does happen. But in all honesty, when we talk about high performing leaders, those individuals are not high performing leaders.
That's right.
Because the high performing leaders take that data and run with it. And they're actually excited for those insights, and they're using them to improve their processes. They're
right.
You know, so, you know, those are obviously we want to work with and want
sure
to emulate.
Well, I tell clients, my clients in city government, I don't do remedial work.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. That's just, I don't find, either in the public or private sector, people don't write, they don't issue purchase orders to try to prevent somebody that they're kicking them out the door, right?
Yeah.
And I would suspect that you're in the same boat. I mean, the people that want to up their game, they're the ones that want your service.
Yeah, you know,
if I'm interested in upping my game, what do I need you for? You know, yeah. I think I've got everything under control. Most fun success story.
Oh, well, I have to, although it is a nonprofit. Can I tell a fun nonprofit success
story? Yeah, I don't care. Yeah.
So one of the highest performing leaders I know is a woman named Lori Leigh Bellhumer, who works for Western Youth Services in Anaheim, Orange County, California. And she was truly embodies what I consider a high performing leader. She works with youth with behavioral challenges, and was bold enough to come to me and say, "Sherry, my organization's mission right now, 1 in 5 kids are diagnosed with a mental health disorder. That is not okay. I want to change that to 1 in 10 in this generation." And I'm like, yes, we will work together because you are bold enough to, one, put a vision out there that is so big and so important and critical. And so, you know, we partnered with her. We helped her get a measurement culture in place so she knew the impact of her work. And because she is dealing with really hard problems to solve, we learned that she was 68%, not her personally, but her organization was 68% successful, meaning 68% of the youth that she solved moved from having, problematic functioning to normal functioning. So that was a great baseline to understand, but her peers in her space, they didn't know how to answer that question. So already she's kind of above the pack because she knows, but we also took it one step farther and was looking at her program that she serves kids in schools. So removes a lot of barriers to accessing behavioral health treatment. And we're able to then show the city of Anaheim that this in-school program was saving the city of Anaheim $38 million a year in community cost. And so with that knowledge, she was able to expand and grow her impact. And so I think the reason that there's so many reasons why I think she's my favorite. I have so many, but one of my favorite success stories is because no one made her do this work. It wasn't, you know, sometimes we get paid because a grant requires an external person to come in and do it. But in this case, her and her board said, nope, this is important to us. We want to be high performing. We want to be data driven. We want to be serving the kids the best that we possibly can. And we want to expand our impact. And that they continuously use this data. This is like 5 years later now. They're still using data to innovate. They're like now with the pandemic, they're still using data to figure out how do we deliver these services virtually and continuing to take a data-driven approach to solving these complex problems.
That's a great story. It's a great story. Mm-hmm. I appreciate your time. It's been
your work
fascinates me. We're going to put links to your website, your LinkedIn profile, and all that. So we encourage everybody in the audience to go to the show notes at growgreat.com. And I appreciate your time, Sherry. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Randy. It's great speaking with you.
In 2006, two of my favorite business management writers, Jeffrey Pfeiffer and Bob Sutton, they published an article in the Harvard Business Review entitled Evidence-Based Management. Sherry's work focuses on providing clients evidence upon which improvements can not only be measured, but improved. And as we strive to accelerate our own human performance as leaders and the performance of the people around us, it's increasingly vital that we take advantage of the tools that can enable us to see our outcomes more accurately. We all prefer to think that the things that we're doing and the way that we're doing it, we are accomplishing exactly what we set out to do. But what if that is not the case, as you heard in some of the stories that Sherry shared with us? What if, in fact, as she discovered with one client, they're working against what we hope to accomplish? You hear me say it often, we are here to help you figure it out. Sherry's company is focused on using hard science coupled with psychology and organizational behavior to help her clients do exactly that. I hope you got value from today's show. Thanks for listening. Be well, do good, grow great. My name is Randy Cantrell. The website is growgreat.com. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio.